Greetings, beloved family. I begin in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Most Merciful. I bear witness that there is but one God. Welcome to the Black Agenda Conversation here on live on social media, facebook.com/Black Agenda Project. Also, Time for an Awakening Radio, part of the Black Talk Radio Network in Philadelphia, across the East Coast. Blessings to all the people across United States, Canada, U.S., the Caribbean, CARICOM nations in particular, and to our people all over the world, because recently we have had an incredible outreach of our brothers and sisters in Kenya, Uganda, Ghana, Nigeria, South Africa, Ethiopia, Cameroon, and other parts of the motherland of Africa, reaching out, getting the videos, getting the messages. And of course, it is a pleasure and a privilege for us to have the opportunity to share this thought. I ask you live on social media to share the message, share the link with our people, and let us grow in consciousness together. Now, this evening, we're looking at the theme of why CARICOM governments in particular should not enforce mandatory vaccination. We know this is a contentious subject. We know this is a hot topic. And we are also mindful of the necessity at some points to speak in parables or read between the lines or skillfully craft our language in such a way to get the message across, because censorship now, of course, is at an all-time unreasonable high. But I want to share with you this evening some key points that must be included into the conversation for us to better have an understanding of where we are today. And I want to sensitize us for this conversation, and literally for all conversations, that we do ourselves an injustice in any arena of conversation, discussion, or dialogue when we do not consider the historical context, looking at the past as a torchlight of illumination onto where we are today. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, of all of our studies, history is best qualified to reward the researcher. Implying that as Black people in the Western Hemisphere, many of our experiences from enslavement, captivity, kidnapping, rape, genocide, torture, dehumanization, and destruction of the Black family, many of these things that happened to us were wickedness, devilishness, pure evil. We understand that. But what I want you to understand this evening in particular is that all of those historical experiences that African people have had were in a context. And if we read or study or recall our history in particular chapters and episodes, but do not link those occurrences to the intent and purpose of the perpetrator who committed those crimes against us in the past, then we will not understand our navigation through the present. If you believe that there was an intention in the past of capturing us, going into Africa, committees of European leaders having meetings with a whole table as a map of Africa and carving up the African continent like it was a cake, drawing lines like it was geometry and technical drawing, and then coming up with a long-term plan of which nations will be Anglophone or Francophone, which nations will be under the Germans or the Belgians, the French, the Spanish, the Portuguese, the Dutch. And then, in addition to that, have some kind of long-term, long-range psychological plan to assault the thinking process of the sons and daughters of Africa as they were kidnapped exiting the motherland. If you believe that there was not, in addition to the economics of slavery, an accompanying psychology of slavery that would have made the process of the economic objectives more efficient by a mind war against the consciousness of African people. If you think that all that you've read in our history books about us being in chains and being marched out and packed into the slave ships like sardines and being submerged for almost 3 months in our own urine, vomit, sweat, and feces in rats, lice, fleas, and roaches, and that all of that happened, but there was not a sociological and a psychological objective behind it, then you are misled and you are looking at our history from an angle that will not help you understand the continuation of the struggle for African people today. So I'm saying to us, all of this has occurred within a context that must be understood in order for us to be able to shed light on the situation that we're in right now. Now, it's so funny, and one of the major ironies behind our existence in the Western Hemisphere after being kidnapped and taken out of Africa is that having that experience and embracing that culture of enslavement, we now have problems, naturally. The Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan said to the black community that we are already equipped, competent, capable, and qualified enough to solve our own problems. And that right now, our biggest impediment is that our own foot is in our own way. But the irony of this is that we are somehow in a frame of mind where the problems that we have were caused by an enemy. But for some reason, we're looking to the same enemy that caused our problems for the solutions. That is not natural. Look at the history of warfare, whether it has been overt or covert, silent or loud, conventional, traditional, nuclear, whatever kind of warfare there has been on any people in all the annals of history, the recovery process has never entailed the victim looking to the perpetrator for the solutions to the problems that were created as a result of being involved in that warfare. No other people but African people. And the thing is, the warfare and the genocide, the mass murder that was committed against us, was bigger and more detrimental and more consequential than any other crimes against humanity or warfare that was ever declared against any other people. What happened to us was the worst of all, but yet still somehow we are looking towards our enemies who did that to us for solutions to the problems that have evolved as a result of that being done to us. I want you to let that process in your consciousness, because that is not normal. We're leading somewhere. That is not natural for you to declare war on people. That's like going over a city, literally dropping bombs on them to destroy them. And then now you're writing letters to the same people who dropped bombs on you and destroyed you, asking them, how can we solve our problems today? Most certainly the answer is not there. And by the fact that we think that way today, by the fact that we have been programmed in that mode today, is indicative of the fact that part of the warfare against African people has been psychological. How is it that African people are the only people today who, based on the reality and depth of all of those historical experiences, We don't think about solving our economic problems by supporting black businesses and creating a black economy and circulating our black dollars among black people. We think the solution to our economic problems is going to our economic oppressors and asking them for a crumb. We don't think that the solution to the mass neglect and rejection and disappointment of the masses of the people is to use the same structure of the political system that we inherited after colonialism and now have black oppressors in offices dressed up like the colonialists themselves and expect them to have empathy on the public. We don't think of reconsulting some kind of traditional means of justice and peace and political administration that we had in multiple African societies that were model societies prior to us coming into contact with the Europeans, where we had no old age homes, no orphanages, no drug rehabilitation centers, and no halfway houses, and no prisons. But rather than us reconnect with those ancient traditions that we had, we say, no, let us be like our enemies. Let's be just like our enslavers and colonizers. Let's try to be like them and see how that works out for us. How is it working out for us? We're doing exactly what the Bible said don't do. Envy not the oppressor and choose none of his ways. And then we get into where we're talking about. We think that after being victims of a health assault, and point number 5 on the CARICOM 10-point plan of action for reparations for slavery, point number 5 is the public health crisis that African people have found themselves in as a result of the enslavement experience. We have been the victims of medical genocide, germ warfare, biological and chemical assaults on our person. We have been injected with experimental jabs. There have been plans written up and designed to test germs on us. And all of that, after all of that, we think, all right, so there's a global pandemic. Let me see if I can get a solution from the same people who committed these crimes against me and my people. Let's get into this. Let's understand this. Let's take an academic view of this. Please continue to share. Of course, social media platforms have adjusted their analytics in a way that we, as conscious people, have to take a more active role in sharing the content. Now, so right now, what is considered to be a major problem is, and we're looking at the Caribbean here, and Black America, the African diaspora in general, so-called vaccine hesitancy. And vaccine hesitancy is a, according to official definitions, a delay in acceptance or refusal of vaccines despite the availability of vaccine services. The term covers outright refusals to vaccinate, delaying vaccines, accepting vaccines but remaining uncertain about their use, or using certain vaccines but not others. The term anti-vaccinationism refers to total opposition to vaccination. In more recent years, anti-vaccinationists have been known as anti-vaxxers or anti-vax. Most of the people who are challenging the current COVID-19 jabs reject the term anti-vaxxers. Vaccine hesitancy is complex and context-specific, varying across time, place, and vaccines. It can be influenced by factors such as lack of proper scientifically based knowledge and understanding about how vaccines are made or how they work, as well as complacency, convenience, or even fear of needles. Interestingly, none of those issues have been center stage in what we're facing currently. Hesitancy primarily results from public debates around the medical, ethical, and legal issues related to vaccines. Vaccine hesitancy stems from multiple key factors, including a person's lack of confidence, mistrust of the vaccine and/or healthcare provider. Complacency, the person does not see a need for the vaccine or does not see the value of it. And convenience, access to them. It has existed since the invention of vaccines and predates the coining of the term vaccine and vaccination. All right. Now, there have been proposed laws that have mandated vaccination in the past, which have been seen as major assaults on the human rights and civil rights of the people. I'm going to give two examples. Number one, the California Senate Bill 277, SB 277. Which is a California law in the United States that removed personal belief as a reason for an exemption from the vaccination requirements for entry into private or public elementary or secondary schools in California, as well as daycare centers. The final version of the bill was enacted by the California legislature in 2015, passing the state assembly on a 46-31 vote and the California State Senate on a 24-14 vote, and was signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown on June 30th, 2015, after the passage of SB 277. Groups of anti-vaccine parents challenged the law in court, arguing that it violated the right to an education, the right to religious freedom, and parental rights. Following the law's enactment, vaccination rates among California school children increased. Although unjustified medical exemptions also increased. The 20% increase in medical exemptions was fueled by anti-vaccination parents who sought and received such exemptions. All right, so let's look at this first example here. Where in California, they passed this law, SB 277, to try to force children into vaccination. And of course, there was a multitude of lawsuits against it. But what happened and what seemed to be successful is that even though the state agreed to remove personal belief as a criteria to refuse a vaccine, and it was a very controversial move, California state, exemptions were given for multiple other reasons that did not occur before. So it was almost like a balance was introduced. Now look at it. There was a replacement effect. Medical exemptions for independent study homeschool students largely offset the decrease in personal belief exemption rate from 2.37% to 0.56%. In a separate study in 2019, published in Pediatrics, California public health officials interviewed after SB 277's enactment said that following the bill's passage, they faced as an increasing amount of unusual reasons cited as justifications for medical exemptions. So I'm giving you two classic cases here. So the one in California where there was this law, I say, no, if you're saying that you're not taking the vaccine because of personal belief, we're now removing that as an option. The lawsuits came out, but a number of other exemptions were given, as they said, had a replacement effect. So the exemptions were still practiced, were still carried out. Second example that I want to give you is in Australia, where they introduced what was called a no jab, no pay policy initiative, which withheld three state payments. One, childcare benefits. Two, the childcare rebate. And three, a portion of the fortnightly family tax benefit. Part A per child for parents of children under 20 years old of age who were not fully immunized or on a recognized catch-up schedule. No jab, no play is a related policy that disallows unvaccinated children from attending preschool and childcare centers and imposes fines on childcare centers that admit unvaccinated children. The system allows exemption for children who cannot be safely vaccinated for medical reasons. And same thing with the no jab, no pay situation in Australia. There was a broadening of exemption reasons. Now, we have gone over a number of times the ICCPR, right? And this ICCPR, which is the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is a United Nations convention that all signature countries agreed that they will not force medical experimentation or scientific treatment on their citizens. Just to recap on this, because we're going to go deeper in a short while. In regards to mandatory vaccines, CARICOM countries, Caribbean countries, including Trinidad and Tobago, Jamaica, Guyana, Barbados, St. Vincent, St. Lucia, St. Kitts, Dominica, Antigua, Grenada, the Bahamas. Caribbean countries have agreed to the ICCPR, International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is a United Nations treaty ratified across the Caribbean. Article 7 of the document says, no one will be subjected without their free consent to medical or scientific experimentation. The ICCPR, International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, by the United Nations, is a multilateral treaty adopted by the United Nations General Assembly Resolution 2200A on December 16, 1966, and came into force from March 23, 1976, in accordance with Article 29 of the Covenant. And as we have gone through several times, you can go on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/blackagenda, for a fuller presentation on this. According to Article 4, your rights can be infringed under some circumstances if, for example, there's a public health state of emergency or suspension of constitutional rights. However, there are certain conditions where you cannot, under any circumstances, interfere with someone's rights, which include the right to personhood, the right to freedom of thought, freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, and freedom from slavery and torture, and freedom from medical or scientific treatment without consent. Trinidad and Tobago signed and ratified this United Nations ICCPR on December 21st, 1978, and it came into force on March 21st, 1979. This was part of our existence as a sovereign state, independent country in the Caribbean that now had their own autonomy, own right to freedom of self-determination, freedom to pass our own laws and create our own constitution in accordance with the fact that we have now become independent nations. And throughout the Caribbean, just to give a few examples, Barbados ratified the United Nations ICCPR on January the 5th, 1973 and enacted it on March 23rd, 1976. Guyana ratified the United Nations ICCPR on February 15th, 1977 and enacted it on May 15th, 1977. Jamaica ratified the United Nations ICCPR on October the 3rd, 1975 and enacted it on March 23rd, 1976. St. Vincent and the Grenadines ratified the ICCPR on November the 9th, 1981 and enacted it on February 9th, 1982. And Antigua, who were the latest to do this, but they still did ratify the United Nations International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights on July the 3rd, 2019. and enacted it on November the 3rd, 2019. Each of these nations and all the others in between agreed in forum with the United Nations that they will not, as free, independent countries, force their citizens into mandatory vaccination. But now something here is bigger than our freedom. Some influence here is bigger than our independence. Some external foreign force has more of an influence on these Caribbean countries than their own heritage and legacy and history of their struggle for independence. And recently we've been doing the history of the four great pillars of CARICOM. Prime Minister Michael Manley of Jamaica, Dr. Eric Williams of Trinidad and Tobago, Forbes Burnham of Guyana, and Errol Barrow of Barbados. Each of these men fought in their own way for the independence of their countries between 1962 and 1966, but in particular, the establishment of CARICOM with the signing of the Treaty of Chagaramas in Trinidad on July the 3rd, 1973, where we formed CARICOM, which was the Caribbean Community. And based on the information that we have, they spied on Dr. Eric Williams as a result of the Freedom of Information Act and the information that came out on WikiLeaks. They showed that they were planning to replace him somehow using language like a coup or replacement or incapacitation of Dr. Eric Williams, and who will be suitable to put him in that place to have another political leader as Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago, and what kind of resistance there might be. These are CIA documents that have been released by these laws. Same thing with Prime Minister Michael Manley of Jamaica, who was supporting the African liberation movement in Angola and also the regime of Cuba to become part of a closer Caribbean community for us as Caribbean nations to strengthen each other. And the top national security advisor of President Richard Nixon, who was Dr. Henry Kissinger, visited Prime Minister Michael Manley in Jamaica in 1975. And he told him, "We strongly disagree and we are concerned with your closeness to the African liberation movement in Angola and to the communist regime of Fidel Castro. And we are asking you to withdraw that support." And Prime Minister Michael Manley said to Dr. Henry Kissinger, "This is not your business. You have no right meddling in our affairs because we became independent already." And based on the Freedom of Information Act, again, and the documents that were released after that, the CIA gave military and financial assistance to the opponent of Michael Manley, who was the prime minister to come, Edward Seaga. And they gave weapons to the supporters on the ground level of the JLP party against the PNP. And what followed was a bloodbath of political murders and assassinations, totaling close to 800 people directly after the CIA's interference in Jamaica. Based on the Freedom of Information Act, they admitted that they instigated the food riots in Jamaica in 1976 to destabilize the government of Prime Minister Michael Manley. And they list three assassination attempts against Prime Minister Michael Manley and an assassination attempt against Bob Marley after he was successful in bringing together probably the two most bitter political rivals ever in the Caribbean. And at that One Love concert in 1976, Bob Marley brought together and made them shake hands, Michael Manley and Edward Seaga, in the midst of this bloodbath that was taking place. And then there was temporarily peace, but that's not what the enemy wanted. And again, he disrupted that condition. Same thing with Forbes Burnham in Guyana, who, just like Dr. Eric Williams did in 1964, Dr. Eric Williams visited Africa and he toured Kenya, Uganda, Ghana, Nigeria, Sierra Leone, Ethiopia, Algeria, and made connections between Africa and the Caribbean. Likewise, Forbes Burnham of Guyana did the same thing in 1970 where he went to Zambia and then toured throughout different African nations and created ties between African people in the Caribbean and African people on the African continent. Just like the Honorable Elijah Muhammad put on the front cover of every Muhammad Speaks newspaper, an image where you see a globe, the world, and a black man in Africa stretching his hands over the globe and clasping his fist with a black man in America, showing and demonstrating the need for that unity. And Forbes Burnham did it. Dr. Eric Williams did it. Michael Manley of Jamaica did it. And then we have the fourth great pillar of CARICOM, Prime Minister Errol Barrow of Barbados, who again was a conscious black man who stood up for his nation with pride. All of them had their issues, because that's how the system is. It is infected. But Errol Barrow of Barbados, who was prime minister for 10 years, 1966 to 1976, then he was opposition leader for 10 years, 1976 to 1986, then he was elected again as prime minister, but mysteriously died after being in office for 1 year. Prime Minister Errol Barrow of Barbados, with strength, fortitude, and resilience, stood up and opposed the American invasion of Grenada in 1983, where massive America bullied and took advantage of a tiny island, Grenada, with at the time less than 100,000 people. And in his first press conference, re-elected as prime minister, Errol Barrow referred to Ronald Reagan as that insane cowboy in the White House who has no business meddling in Caribbean affairs. I'm sharing this conscious history with you for a reason. Now, those four heads of government of Jamaica, Barbados, Guyana, and Trinidad and Tobago, during their time, had the strength to stand up and say, no, you cannot disrespect our independence. No, you cannot disrespect our sovereignty. No, you cannot try to treat us as if we are some colony of yours in a backyard beach paradise when you're ready for a holiday. Those days are long gone. But something about 2021, it would appear that we are like puppets on a string for some foreign entity that is carrying out a remote control. And we have to revisit the days of our consciousness as a nation and reinstill that respect for us as a people. It's embarrassing, beloved. So we have been highlighting that it appears, and it has been said on several occasions, but we said we have to corroborate the evidence properly and get the proper facts. But I think we are at the point now where there's enough information for us to openly be able to say that Caribbean governments have been offered inducements and mandates by foreign interests to vaccinate their populations to at least 70%. This has not been working out based on the same vaccine hesitancy that we explained at the beginning of the program. So it appears that a new desperate measure is to go after the children. You cannot get 70% of the adults to do it. So we're going after the children now. And let me say something to you. I became a school teacher at age 19. And I developed a reputation as a young school teacher in my early 20s. In all the different districts that I taught at across Trinidad. That if I were to see a child, let's say it's recess time or lunchtime, and I step out to the school compound, and I see one of the children in my class riding a bike or skateboarding or going somewhere, and then I would call them and say, come, why are you out of school? And they will answer, well, sir, this morning, I didn't have the right shoes, or didn't have the right uniform, or I woke up too late, or all kinds, all manner of excuses. And I developed a reputation. I started teaching in Laventille in 1993, in Sangre Grande, that was my first appointment, 1990 itself, in Carenage, in St. Augustine, anywhere that I was. I'll say, all right, come with me. And I will put them to sit in my class, sometimes in their home clothes or with slippers or whatever. So you need lunch? Here's lunch. You didn't have your books? Here, these are books. I'm going to give you a pen, a pencil, eraser, paper, copybook. Here, anything you need. Because your education was much more important than any other trivial excuse that you had not to attend school. And I was always like that. Sometimes I'll see some students who are grown up now, and we may recall episodes like that. And when the parents would come and see me the next day or whatever the case was, I'd say, there is no excuse to keep your child home from school. Whatever the issue. Of course, there are exceptions from time to time. But this consciousness, yes, my Islamic beliefs and my black consciousness and all of that, fine. But I grew up in a home where from kindergarten, literally as a toddler, all the way up to Form 6 in Trinity College, I missed 2 days of school. It was a Monday and a Wednesday. I was in Standard 3. Outside of that, every living day, my parents sent me to school. It could be last day of school where we weren't doing anything, whatever it was. Went to school every day. And I inherited that from my parents. And everywhere that I was as a school teacher on the primary level, I said, once I see you outside of school and school is going on, come. And even now that I'm not in that dimension of the profession anymore, I see, wait, you look like you're supposed to be in school. What's the story? I would have never dreamt that we would come to a day and time where the government themselves are telling the children they cannot go to school because of a vaccine. That is despicable. But it's not us. It's not who we are, as the Prime Minister of Barbados said. Who are we following? Why are we doing this to our own? And the thing is, we can all see how absurd this is because, of course, for my PhD research, Black Youth at Risk, from Juvenile Delinquency to Criminal Gang Activity, for the research in this book, I interviewed close to, I mean, hundreds of references, but at least 40 or 50 school teachers in the system on juvenile delinquency from criminal gang activity. And of course, I reconnected with a lot of these teachers over the past week or so, and in many schools. In fact, I think I am correct in saying in most government schools, there are more teachers than students showing up for school. In one particular school, it was reported that there were 52 teachers and 7 students. In another school, the teacher told me that she was informed by her principal to stay at home because none of your children seem to be vaccinated and are coming to the school. Stay home and teach them. Why are we doing this? Especially after all that talk about children not at risk and they won't be spreading the virus. All that talk. It's like we reverse almost everything that is said just a few months after it is said. And now this so-called safe zones issue. Who would have ever imagined that we would have come to this? All right. Your alcohol, as a matter of fact, that's probably the only thing in this whole scenario that I can agree with. All right, ban the alcohol. Yeah. Say what you want. Muslim extremists, whatever. So your alcohol, your restaurants and your bars, your rum shops, that's your business. Fine. You want to tell the people they can't go into the rum shops and drink the alcohol if they don't have a vaccine? That's your business. But the schools? Don't be a devil, which is one who deprives of knowledge. And then the attempt to bamboozle the public by taking the television cameras to the so-called prestige elitist schools where a significant amount of children showed up. This is a new depth of evil, beloved. It's not right. And I believe that it would not last that long, especially when the white people start losing sales and profit. So let me begin to conclude, and I want to share with you something that's a bit heavy. And let me close up on this first part here. So as I was saying, it seems now that there's sufficient evidence that Caribbean countries are being coerced or bribed or offered inducements. Now, it was reported on September 22nd, 2021, that the chairman of CARICOM, who at the time was Dr. Keith Rowley, wrote to both United States President Joe Biden and Director General of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom, proposing the need for a global summit to address the vaccine issue. Then it was posted, because the summit took place, was posted on September 22nd, that at this summit, the United States President Joe Biden committed to A, increased donation of vaccines, B, assisting in scaling up of vaccine manufacturing in other countries around the world with the support of India, Japan, Australia, and South Africa. C, this is where the spotlight is on right now. C, providing $300 million US dollars to tackle vaccine hesitancy. D was allocating $350 million US dollars for a COVAX facility. Then also greater support for global bulk oxygen availability and increased testing capacity in preparation for the next pandemic. And also the United States President agreed that no one is safe until everyone is safe, and therefore there is a need to share expertise and experience. And of course, there were a number of other statements. But let's look at C and D. That's $650 million US dollars. But $300 million US dollars specifically to tackle vaccine hesitancy. Now, if you're hesitant about something, it means that you're showing some kind of reluctance based on skepticism. If you're hesitant or reluctant about something, it means you have a view or an opinion. And this view or opinion is based on a perspective after you have processed, evaluated, and analyzed information. So now $300 million US dollars is being invested to ensure that there is a change in the minds of people who have opinions based on information that they would have received. This is where the danger comes in. So hundreds of millions of US dollars, according to this summit that was held with United States President Joe Biden and countries in the Caribbean, hundreds of millions of dollars being spent not for medical treatment, the upgrade of hospitals, more hospital beds that are needed, health clinics, or equipment, scanners and suits, even masks. Hundreds of millions of dollars being invested to change your opinion. And whose opinion was it that our opinions need to change? And those leaders of Caribbean countries, many of which that we have met, that we have interacted with, I was blessed to be with the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, accompanying him as we met both prime ministers and opposition leaders or opposition leaders in several countries. And in Guyana and Jamaica, we met opposition leaders and prime ministers, even in the absence of Minister Farrakhan. But in Grenada, in Trinidad, in, of course, Jamaica, Guyana, Barbados, Antigua, Dominica, why are they investing hundreds of millions of dollars to try to change the way we think about something that we're justified in being skeptical about? Let me speed up. In that great book, Behold a Pale Horse, by William Cooper, formerly of the CIA, who resigned from the CIA based on his concern over some of the dastardly actions that they were involved in, he writes on page 36 of this great book, Behold a Pale Horse, quote, "It is patently impossible to discuss social engineering on a worldwide scale without implying extensive objectives of social control, destruction of human life, slavery, and genocide." Now, based on this summit that the President of the United States had with Caribbean leaders, on the request of Caribbean leaders, and him saying that he wants to put $300 million to combat vaccine hesitancy, in other words, to change our views, opinions, our thoughts, our ideas, our feelings about this vaccine situation, $300 million. That's a lot of money. You could do some public advertisement campaign for a little $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 and reach across the region if you put it on the right. But $300 million? That is social engineering. Here we have the smoking gun with the finger on the trigger. The clear evidence that America has openly stated their intention to invest $300 million in changing our minds. That is social engineering. And William Cooper, formerly of the CIA, is saying that it is patently impossible to discuss social engineering on a worldwide scale without implying extensive objectives of social control, destruction of human life, slavery, and genocide. This document noted, such a writing must be secured from public scrutiny. Otherwise, it might be recognized as a technically formal declaration of domestic war. This is why mainly Caribbean governments must not mandate vaccination for their populations. I respect everyone's opinion, whether it is to take the vaccine or not take the vaccine. That is your personal and individual choice. But when you're talking about forcing someone to do something like this and spending $300 million to change their mind about it if they're against it, that is social engineering. It is a mind war. Page 37 says, silent weapon technology. Silent weapon technology has evolved from operations research a strategic and tactical methodology developed under the military management in England during World War II. Its original purpose was to study the strategic and tactical problems of air and land defense with the objective of effective use of limited military resources against foreign enemies. Investments. So what they're saying basically is this is the kind of social engineering achieving warfare objectives that can be done now. You don't have to shoot a gun at anyone. You don't have to fire a missile or torpedo at anyone. You don't have to drop a bomb on anyone. But you can assault the mind with an objective of social engineering and mind control that will have the same effect as killing them. On page 59 of the book, Mass Control, Engineering Human Consciousness by Jim Keith, in a chapter entitled The CIA and Control, the author says, CIA mind control experimentation emerged full-blown under Project Bluebird in 1947 that sought an exploitable alteration of personality through testing a wide variety of drugs under the supervision of security operator Morse Allen. At the same time, the United States Navy was doing its own drug experimentation under Project Chatter, a project that sought a truth drug. Our beloved sister, Dr. Ava Muhammad, said, thoughts are things. So when a thought is divinely energized with truth, it has more power than any laser beam. And now there is a war on our minds. They are not satisfied with the opinions that we have. So whereas hundreds of millions of dollars are needed globally for food, clothing, and shelter for suffering people, they're taking that $300 million and using it to change the way that we think about vaccines. And I don't care what your personal opinion is. And again, I said I respect everyone's view or decision to take a vaccine or not take a vaccine. But whether you want to take it or not, I'm sure in your heart and in your conscience, you would disagree with spending this kind of money to change opinions about it and to try to social engineer populations into thinking differently. There's so much more on this, but I'm going to just touch a little bit to take us up to the end of the hour. Now, I'm going to run through some of this information here over the next few short minutes with rapid fire. In Pakistan, the CIA ran a fake vaccination clinic in an attempt to locate Osama bin Laden. As a direct consequence, there have been several attacks and deaths among vaccination workers. Several Islamist preachers and militant groups, including some factions of the Taliban, view vaccination as a plot to kill or sterilize Muslims. Now, they don't say what they were doing with that false vaccination clinic because they administered injections that caused serious harm, but they did it in the name of trying to catch Osama bin Laden. In July 2021, the police in India arrested 14 people for administering doses of fake salt water vaccines instead of the AstraZeneca vaccine at nearly a dozen private vaccination sites in Mumbai. The organizers, including medical professionals, charged between $10 and $70 for each dose, and more than 2,600 people paid to receive the vaccine. Another awkward story. Now, let me hit the road here and still share this. So we have had several cases of African people being the victims of chemical and biological warfare and medical genocide. We spoke about the Tuskegee experiment, talked about the cancer-causing monkey virus SV40 and the polio vaccines. We spoke about AIDS in Africa through the smallpox vaccination campaign, Let me close with some swift examples here. In the 1920s and 1930s, Aboriginal Australians were subject to medical experiments on how they experienced pain and where body measurements and blood samples were forcibly taken. The experiments were motivated by a system of scientific racism and were carried out by researchers from the University of Adelaide. In 2002, the Vice Chancellor of the University described the experiments as degrading and in some cases barbarous. They apologized after the fact. Canada has historically carried out unethical medical experiments on Indigenous populations in concert with its policies of forced cultural assimilation, similar to spending $300 million to change our opinions about vaccines. They wanted the Native American Indians to become more like the Canadians in thought, the white Canadians. In 1933, about 600 Native children from a reservation were enrolled into a trial to test the tuberculosis vaccine. In both control and treatment groups, nearly a fifth of them died from exposure, malnutrition, and other causes. I'm skipping ahead. One of the ugliest of them all, the Guatemalan medical experiments from 1946 to 1948. United States scientific researchers in Guatemala infected hundreds of mental patients with sexually transmittable diseases. Researchers from the United States Public Health Service, the PHS, conducted experiments on approximately 1,500 male and female Guatemalans housed at the National Mental Health Hospital. The scientists injected the patients with gonorrhea and syphilis and encouraged many of them to pass the disease on to others. The experiments were done in cooperation with the Guatemalan government at the time. In Sweden, the Vibehold experiments were a series of human experiments where patients of the Vibehold Hospital for intellectually disabled in Sweden were fed large amounts of sweets to provoke dental cavities between 1945 and 1955. The experiments were sponsored both by the sugar industry and the dentist community in an effort to determine whether carbohydrates affected the formation of cavities in teeth. I think I'll have to do a whole part two based on the amount of information we have left, but I'll just read the beginning of this. United Kingdom declassified documents from the National Archives revealed that during the 20th century in England, scientists from Porton Down conducted experiments on British and Indian soldiers to test the effects of mustard gas. From 1916 all the way up to 1989, more than 20,000 British servicemen, most of them ethnic minorities selected when they can, were subjected to chemical warfare trials. The experiments on Indian servicemen were conducted in British India during the 1930s and 1940s. Skipping ahead, because there's one in particular that I want to get to. I'll close with this one. Radiation experiments in the United States. Researchers in the United States performed thousands of human radiation experiments to determine the effects of atomic radiation and radioactive contamination on the human body. Generally on people who were poor, sick, black, ethnic minorities, or powerless. Most of these tests were performed, funded, or supervised by the United States Military Atomic Energy Commission and various other United States federal government agencies. Example, in a 1949 operation called the Green Run, the United States Atomic Energy Commission released iodine-131 into the atmosphere near the Hanford site in Washington, which contaminated a 500,000 acre area, containing three small towns. In 1953, they ran several studies at the University of Iowa on the health effects of radioactive iodine in newborns and pregnant women. In one study, researchers gave pregnant women between 100 to 200 microcuries of iodine-131 to study women's aborted embryos in an attempt to discover at what stage and to what extent radioactive iodine crosses the placental barrier. In another study, they gave 25 newborn babies who were under 36 hours old and weighed from 5.5 to 8.5 pounds iodine-131, either by oral administration or through an injection, so that they could measure the amount of iodine in their thyroid glands as thyroid would go to that gland. it goes on and on, brother. But I'll close with this one. The story of a great black woman named Henrietta Lacks. And Henrietta Lacks, may Allah be pleased with her, born in 1920, is a classic case of our relationship with their medical empire. Henrietta Lacks, born August the 1st, 1920. She died on October the 4th, 1951. She was a black woman in the United States whose cancer cells were the source of what is called the HeLa, HeLa cell line, the first immortalized human cell line. This is a black woman who was diagnosed with cancer and one of the most important cell lines in medical research. An immortalized cell line reproduces indefinitely under scientific conditions, and the HeLa cell line continues to be a source of invaluable medical data to the present day. Her cells were in high demand and put into mass reproduction. They were mailed to scientists around the globe for research into cancer, AIDS, the effects of radiation and toxic substance, gene mapping, and countless other scientific pursuits. Her cells were the first ever human cells that were successfully cloned in 1955. A black woman named Henrietta Lacks. That might sound good. But neither her nor her family gave any permission to harvest her cells, and they had no knowledge that she was being used for scientific experimentation. There are almost 11,000 patients involving HeLa cells. This is another example of us not knowing what is going on. At that time, permission was neither required nor customarily sought, but her cells were used in medical research and for commercial purposes. In the 1980s, family medical records were published without family consent, and a similar issue was brought up in the Supreme Court of California case Moore versus Regents of the University of California in 1990. The court ruled that a person's discarded tissue and cells are not their property and can be commercialized. But in March 2013, researchers published the DNA sequence of the genome of a strain of Henrietta Lacks' cells. The Lacks family discovered this only when the author, Rebecca Skloot, informed them. There were objections from the Lacks family about the genetic information that was available for public access. And Jerry Lacks Y, a grandchild of Henrietta Lacks, said to the New York Times, quote, "The biggest concern was privacy. What information was actually going to be out there about our grandmother, and what information that they can obtain from her sequencing that will tell them about her children and grandchildren and going down the line." Do you think they don't know who those children and grandchildren are? Probably follow them to a restaurant and pick up a cup that they used or a knife and fork that they had? It's insane. And I say all of this research, all of this information, a lot of it is in Black Studies, beloved, where there's a whole section on medical genocide against African people. Beloved, we are justified in having our own opinions without the President of the United States openly telling our Caribbean leaders that he's going to invest $300 million to combat vaccine hesitancy, or to engage in social engineering on the minds of Caribbean people. Governments of the Caribbean, you should not and you must not try to force your populations into mandatory vaccination. Rely on the freedom of choice and intelligence of your citizens. And let's just follow the basic methods that we know can keep us safe. From the social distancing, the mask wearing, the hand sanitizing, the contact tracing, taking all the precautions, boosting your immune system, which is what worked for us. Stop rigging the statistics about the deaths from COVID-19. because they have admitted, Dr. Avery Hines admitted, that the numbers of deaths that we have from COVID-19 are not from people necessarily who died because of COVID-19, but who died with COVID-19. So when someone dies from some other reason and they test the body and that person is COVID positive, they list the death as COVID positive. That is wrong. It is dishonest. It's misleading. We need to stop doing that for the sole purpose of trying to frighten the public into going to take this jab. Beloved, go to www.blackagendaproject.com. You can get the books, Black Studies, Knowledge is Power, and Black Youth at Risk from Juvenile Delinquency to Criminal Gang Activity. You can get the digital downloads that go straight onto your laptop or your computer or your phone or your digital device or your tablet. Also, on the website, we have our online radio station, blackagendaproject.com. It's also on the TuneIn app. And African Expo number 9 at the Kwame Ture Center, Saturday, October 30th, 2021. See you there. Beloved family, thank you so much for being in our viewing and listening audience. May Almighty God Allah continue to bless you. Go to our Instagram page, instagram.com/blackagenda. Go to our YouTube channel. Get more information on this. youtube.com/blackagendaproject. We're on facebook.com/blackagendaproject, but also visit our TikTok account. You get short excerpts of some powerful information in a capsule. TikTok.com/blackagendaproject. May Almighty God Allah continue to bless you. As I greet you in peace. Assalamu alaikum.